Chapter 34. The Renaissance of Western Civilization. Land ways give place to sea ways. First, Christianity and popular education. Second, Europe begins to think for itself. Third, the Great Plague and the dawn of communism. Fourth, how paper liberated the human mind. Fifth, Protestantism of the princes and Protestantism of the peoples. Sixth, the reawakening of science. Seventh, the new growth of European towns. Eighth, America comes into history. Ninth, what Machiavelli thought of the world. Tenth, the Republic of Switzerland. 11th A, the life of the Emperor Charles V. 11th B, Protestants, if the prince wills it. 11th C, the intellectual undertow. First, judged by the map, the 3 centuries from the beginning of the 13th to the end of the 15th century were an age of recession for Christendom. These centuries were the age of the Mongolian peoples. Nomadism from Central Asia dominated the known world. At the crest of this period, there were rulers of Mongol or the kindred Turkish race and nomadic tradition in China, India, Persia, Egypt, North Africa, the Balkan peninsulas, Hungary, and Russia. The Ottoman Turk had even taken to the sea and fought the Venetian upon his own Mediterranean waters. In 1529, the Turks besieged Vienna and were defeated rather by the weather than by the defenders. The Habsburg Empire of Charles V paid the Sultan tribute. It wasn't until the Battle of Lepanto in 1571, the battle in which Cervantes, the author of Don Quixote, lost his left arm, that Christendom, to use his words, broke the pride of the Osmans and undeceived the world which had regarded the Turkish fleet as invincible. The sole region of Christian advance was Spain. A man of foresight, surveying the world in the early 16th century, might well have concluded that it was only a matter of a few generations before the whole world became Mongolian, and probably Muslim. Just as today, most people seem to take it for granted that European rule and a sort of liberal Christianity are destined to spread over the whole world. Few people seem to realize how recent a thing is this European ascendancy. It was only as the 15th century drew to its close that any indications of the real vitality of Western Europe became clearly apparent. Our history is now approaching our own times, and our study becomes more and more a study of the existing state of affairs. The European or Europeanized system in which the reader is living is the same system that we see developing in the crumpled-up, Mongol-threatened Europe of the early 15th century. Its problems then were the embryonic form of the problems of today. It's impossible to discuss that time without discussing our own time. We become political in spite of ourselves. Politics without history has no root, said Sir J. R. Seeley. History without politics has no fruit. Let's try, with as much detachment as we can achieve, to discover what the forces were that were dividing and holding back the energies of Europe during this tremendous outbreak of the Mongol peoples, and how we're to explain the accumulation of mental and physical energy that undoubtedly went on during this phase of apparent retrocession, and which broke out so impressively at its close. Now, just as in the Mesozoic Age, while the great reptiles lorded it over the earth, there were developing in odd out-of-the-way corners those hairy mammals and feathered birds who were finally to supersede that tremendous fauna altogether by another far more versatile and capable, so, in the limited territories of Western Europe of the Middle Ages, while the Mongolian monarchies dominated the world from the Danube to the Pacific, and from the Arctic seas to Madras and Morocco and the Nile, the fundamental lines of a new and hardier and more efficient type of human community were being laid down. This type of community, which is still only in the phase of formation, which is still growing and experimental, we may perhaps speak of as the modern state. This is, we must recognize, a vague expression, but we'll endeavor to get meaning into it as we proceed. We've noted the appearance of its main root ideas in the Greek republics, and especially in Athens, in the great Roman Republic, in Judaism, in Islam, and in the story of Western Catholicism. Essentially, this modern state, as we see it growing under our eyes today, is a tentative combination of two apparently contradictory ideas. The idea of a community of faith and obedience, such as the earliest civilizations undoubtedly were, and the idea of a community of will, such as were the primitive political groupings of the Nordic and Hunnish peoples. For thousands of years, the settled, civilized peoples, who were originally, in most cases, dark white Caucasians or Dravidian or southern Mongolian peoples, seem to have developed their ideas and habits along the line of worship and personal subjection, and the nomadic peoples, theirs, along the line of personal self-reliance and self-assertion. Naturally enough, under the circumstances, the nomadic peoples were always supplying the civilizations with fresh rulers and new aristocracies. That's the rhythm of all early history. It was only after thousands of years of cyclic changes between refreshment by nomadic conquest, civilization, decadence, and fresh conquest, that the present process of a mutual blending of civilized and free tendencies into a new type of community that now demands our attention, and which is the substance of contemporary history, began. We've traced in this history the slow development of larger and larger civilized human communities from the days of the primitive Paleolithic family tribe. We've seen how the advantages and necessities of cultivation, the fear of tribal gods, the ideas of the priest-king and the god-king, played their part in consolidating continually larger and more powerful societies in regions of maximum fertility. We've watched the interplay of priest, who was usually native, and monarch, who was usually a conqueror in those early civilizations, the development of a written tradition and its escape from priestly control, and the appearance of novel forces, at first apparently incidental and secondary, which we've called the free intelligence and the free conscience of mankind. We've seen the rulers of the primitive civilizations of the river valleys widening their area and extending their sway. And simultaneously, over the less fertile areas of the earth, we've seen mere tribal savagery develop into a more and more united and politically competent nomadism. Steadily and divergently, mankind pursued one or other of these two lines. For long ages, all the civilizations grew and developed along monarchist lines, upon lines of absolute monarchy, and in every monarchy and dynasty we've watched, as if it were a necessary process, efficiency and energy give way to pomp, indolence, and decay, and finally succumb to some fresher lineage from the desert or the steppe. The story of the early cultivating civilizations and their temples and courts and cities bulks large in human history, but it's well to remember that the scene of that story was never more than a very small part of the land surface of the globe. Over the greater part of the earth, until quite recently, until the last 2,000 years, the hardier, less numerous tribal peoples of forest and parkland, and the nomadic peoples of the seasonal grasslands, maintained and developed their own ways of life. The primitive civilizations were, we may say, communities of obedience. Obedience to God kings, or kings under gods, was their cement. The nomadic tendency, on the other hand, has always been towards a different type of association, which we shall here call a community of will. In a wandering, fighting community, the individual must be at once self-reliant and disciplined. The chiefs of such communities must be chiefs who are followed, not masters who compel.